Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. One of the most perplexing medical mysteries is the reason for sudden unexpected death in an apparently healthy infant. Our phone numbers are 550-8422 in Anchorage. Outside of Anchorage, you can call us toll-free at 1-800-478-8255. Our email address is lineone, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at aprn.org. Coming up next hour, we'll discuss sudden infant death syndrome on Line One, Your Health Connection.
Today's program is underwritten in part by The Lake Otis Pharmacy, prescriptions, support hose, medical equipment, and a full selection of satellites in Alaska. The Lake Otis Pharmacy on Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor, with the wheelchair on the sign. Providence, Alaska combines state-of-the-art technology with a team of skilled and experienced physicians and nurses. With locations in Anchorage, Wasilla, Seward, Valdez, and Kodiak, Providence offers needed medical care close to home. For more information, log on to providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence, Alaska Medical Center.
Welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Our topic today is sudden infant death syndrome. Our phone numbers in Anchorage are familiar to you if you listen to APRN's Talk of Alaska. In Anchorage, it's 550-8422. Our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255. And our email address, lineone@aprn.org. My guest today is Dr. Brad Gessner. He's an epidemiologist with the state of Alaska. Before we get started, I want to mention that next week's guest will be Washington, D.C. healthcare economist Dr. Gail Walensky, and we'll be discussing how healthcare reform is going to affect our healthcare of individuals and also how our economy will be affected. So I think it'll be another very good program with someone who's right in the middle of what's happening back in Washington. Dr. Gessner, welcome back again to Line One, Your Health Connection.
Thanks. Good to be here.
I asked you to come on because, one, I don't think we've ever discussed sudden infant death syndrome, and you've been doing research, among other things, for the state of Alaska on sudden infant death. So I thought it was a reasonable topic. We don't hear about it quite as much as we used to.
Yes, I think that's true.
And that's good.
That's probably good because I think the rates are going down, but part of it is that a lot of the deaths are being assigned to other causes that are specific, as more and more is known about SIDS. So it's not necessarily the case that fewer deaths are occurring, mainly recently, but at least we're finding out more and more causes, so hopefully that will change in the future.
So this is a recurrent theme. We know more and more and more about what causes healthcare issues. Diagnostic categories get changed, and that affects rates in various ways, both, I guess, up and down, but more often down.
Yeah. I mean, I think and specifically in the case of SIDS, there was a big change in the late 90s, mid to late 90s, when prone sleeping was found to be a risk factor. And there were a lot of campaigns that were variations of what's called in the U.S. the Back to Sleep campaign. And that led to reductions in different countries of anywhere from 40 to 80% in SIDS. But since then, since 2000, 2001, mortality rates after the first month of life for infants have been fairly static, but SIDS rates continue to go down, and I think that's because what's called SIDS just keeps changing. And as we know more, we assign those deaths to other categories.
That are probably correctly being assigned.
That are probably correctly being assigned.
Right.
Things like metabolic disorders or specific mechanisms of suffocation or intentional injuries, things like that.
And you mentioned before the program maybe even some hereditary heart defects that are being recognized a little bit, which we can talk about a little bit later.
Right. I mean, I think that there's the one specific study. There's a electrical conduction disorder of the heart that some infants are born with. And a very elegant study of, I think it was something like 10,000 infants that had an EKG at birth and then were followed over time showed that it's a few percent of SIDS is probably a cardiac arrhythmia, maybe a ventricular fibrillation or something like that, but something that would be hard to prevent unless you did EKGs of every infant born.
Mm-hmm. And that – I hate we're getting a little bit ahead of the game, but while we're on it, what this researcher did is basically could in retrospect, maybe could predict which kids were at higher risk based on an EKG done at birth.
Right. It's not that every kid that had this finding died of SIDS, but the kids that had this finding were more likely to die of SIDS. And overall, you could model that and predict that several percent of all SIDS cases probably were among children that died because of that defect.
Okay. All right. Let's take 1 second again and remind our listeners, if you have questions or comments about what you hear today, you can reach us at 550-8422 if you're local, 550-8422. Toll-free number 1-800-478-8255 and email at lineone, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, at aprn.org. So let's get back to the basics. If we're going to look at something, then we really – one of the first rules is to really define what we're talking about. So we're really looking at apples and apples to make it more easy to understand. So what is sudden infant death syndrome? If we're going to go out and do some research, what are we looking at?
Well, as you said, SIDS is sudden infant death syndrome. And as a syndrome, it has a specific case definition that's been developed by the CDC and various other groups that work on SIDS. And basically, it requires a complete evaluation and in an infant and then to come up with no known cause. So it requires a death scene investigation, a clinical history, and an autopsy that are all within a certain set of criteria that have been established by the CDC. And in theory, if you don't have that level of investigation, it should more properly be considered sudden unexplained death of an infant versus this specific syndrome, which is a diagnosis of exclusion. Now, having said that, you mentioned comparing apples to apples, and I think it's virtually impossible to compare apples to apples with SIDS because the degree of pursuit of an etiology is entirely dependent on the medical system in a particular jurisdiction. So.
And the ability to define that illness specifically. I thought that's what you were going to say. We don't necessarily have a precise marker for this disease, and that's what makes it different.
Right. We don't have a precise marker, so it's dependent on how aggressively somebody pursues that diagnosis. So did they do really a complete investigation? Did they really pursue whether the parents were drinking alcohol that night, whether there was cigarette exposure, whether there was a likelihood of intentional injury? Did they do an autopsy that was really an exceptional autopsy by a pediatric pathologist, or is it an adult forensic pathologist that didn't have much interest in mm-hmm. child deaths or possibly even training? So all of those are issues that will affect the rate of disease called SIDS.
Mm-hmm. And as someone who's doing research or looking into this day to day, one of the things you commented about before we went on the program is a lot of research, unfortunately, is not necessarily extremely well done in that some of the basics that appear to me as basics are shortcutted, probably due to financial constraints. And you mentioned just looking at medical records. There's so much – so it's so easy to just get computerized information about deaths, but nobody really goes and looks at the paperwork, which takes time and money.
Yes, time and money and a lot of work.
And yeah.
So – yeah, no, I mean, I think that the basis for SIDS research should really be reviewing medical records. And what you're talking about is that every state in the country sends vital records data to the National Center for Health Statistics. And on vital records are death certificates, and on every death certificate is a cause of death that's assigned by somebody. And then there are researchers and epidemiologists who just analyze those tapes. And so when they see SIDS, they identify risk groups for SIDS and variations in different places in the country. But unless you know what it means when somebody assigned that diagnosis, to me the data is uninterpretable. So unless and it can change over time, as we were discussing earlier. So it's not even the case that you can compare trends over time. Mm-hmm. You really just have no idea unless somebody has actually gone to the medical records and done the hard work.
So it's another problem for those of us. It's very easy to get online nowadays and look up information, but what you don't know is the quality of the information, and that's what you're getting at here, and really making critical decisions from a public health standpoint, which is what your job is, really requires the diligence to look at things, the quality of the information as well as the quantity of the information.
Exactly. I mean, I think I'll just, I mean, I can point out three very large issues with a lot of SIDS research. So first is that people, many reports are reports of death certificate data without any review of the medical records. A second one is if you look at trends in SIDS, but no data on post-neonatal mortality, you can be fooled into thinking SIDS rates have gone down when in fact those are just being reclassified into another cause of death. So you really have to compare SIDS rates over time to all deaths in infancy over time. And then the third one is that if you're looking at risk factor data, that you really need to control for the things that we know already cause SIDS. So for example, if you were going to assign, say that alcohol was related to SIDS, you would have to control for cigarette smoking, because maybe any association between alcohol and SIDS is just due to the fact that people who drink also smoke, and we know smoking is probably the largest prenatal risk factor for SIDS. So, and that happens frequently in the literature, and there's very few studies that have really controlled for those types of risk factors. So it can really give you a distorted view of what things we should attack from a public health perspective.
Boy, I keep hearing it over and over and over. Good science is really hard to do.
Yes.
It takes a lot of work.
It does take a lot of work. That's why I hired good people. So.
All right. So we've been talking on this program a couple of times in the last couple of months about epidemiology. Let me ask you one more time to kind of tell me what epidemiology is, and then let's define what do we know, what's the good epidemiology, since we're focusing on really good stuff, about sudden infant death. What do we know about that?
Well, epidemiology is basically the study of diseases and populations in the broadest context. So it's not clinical medicine. It's very rarely case series, and it's definitely not laboratory research or physiology or things like that, although it's good to have some basis in that in order to interpret epidemiologic findings. Mm-hmm. So that's what we do in the unit where I work. Which is, like you said, in the state of Alaska, and we have a team that analyzes the data on infant mortality and child deaths as well. And so some of the things that are known to be associated with SIDS that I think are really well documented, as we discussed, first is prenatal cigarette exposure. And it's actually more strongly related than postnatal cigarette exposure, and that's probably because the prenatal cigarette exposure actually affects what's called the infant's hypoxic drive to breathe. So they're just less likely to move their head and find oxygen when their airway gets obstructed by a blanket or a pillow or something like that. So they pass out and then they die because their head is still in the same compromised position. And postnatal smoking,
because they're really just because of the smoking that affects the nervous system in a way that they don't get the message well enough to change. And
right. And that's the theory. And I should say that one of the things to be that I think is important to emphasize is that for epidemiology and for public health, you don't necessarily need to have an airtight, biologically plausible physiologic mechanism defined. Mm-hmm. So an example of that is cigarette smoking and lung cancer. The data showing a really strong association between those was defined well before any biologic mechanism for how cigarette smoke could cause lung cancer was identified.
Right.
And so the theory is what I just said, but whether that turns out to be the reason or not, or the entire reason, I don't know. But I think the important thing is the association is so strong that the odds that it's not a true association, I think, are almost zero. So that's one of the key things that we focus on, is trying to convince mothers while they're pregnant and then parents after the child is born, not to smoke cigarettes. And it goes beyond just the risk of exposing the infant in the room. It's actually the parent smoking the cigarettes, and that gets into co-sleeping and what the risk of cigarette smoking and alcohol drinking does for that factor. Then there are other things like male sex, and it's not entirely clear why males are at more risk. There's definitely different racial groups have a higher risk of SIDS. And in Alaska, what's particularly important is Alaska Native infants have a much higher rate of SIDS and infant death after the first month of life as well. And that's, I don't think I mentioned that, but that's considered post-neonatal mortality. So they have a higher rate of post-neonatal mortality. There are genetic factors that probably play a role, like the prolonged QT syndrome. And again, in Alaska, one reason Alaska Native infants may have an increased risk is because of a genetic variant that we've just identified through newborn screening called CPT1 deficiency. So we don't know whether that plays a role at all yet, but mm-hmm. it may. Mm-hmm. So these are all factors that can contribute. And then inappropriate bedding epidemiologically is for sure a risk factor. And inappropriate bedding would include things like water beds, really heavy blankets, sleeping bags where you have a lot of thick blankets. And the idea is to think about how an infant could suffocate. And then the third one, which is probably the strongest one, the next one is one we've already talked about, which is sleep position. And so prone sleeping, when that was discouraged, really decreased the risk of SIDS when people stopped putting their infants to sleep and face down. But also the side position is associated with an increased risk of SIDS. So the safest position is the supine, which is placing the infant to sleep on its back.
One just brief point of clarification. When if those of you who have been listening from the beginning, we talked about a heart conduction problem at the beginning, and Dr. Gessner mentioned a long, prolonged QT interval just a second ago as a risk, and that was the conduction problem. And that has to do with the transmission of the electrical activity from through the heart that drives your heart to beat. And there is, as he mentioned earlier, an apparent at least one study that seems to have an ability to predict a risk based on an abnormality seen on a EKG called a prolonged QT interval, which also can be in adults. I'm not an expert here, an issue with medications as well, so it can get more confounding.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And I think just to summarize it, several people ascribe to the sort of their splitters, I guess, but what's called the triple risk hypothesis for SIDS. So that is a pre-existing vulnerable infant, most likely from a prenatal event, and that could include cigarette exposure, it could include preterm birth, it could include a genetic issue, with a vulnerable developmental period, and that's probably why SIDS is isolated to the first 6 months of life almost completely. And then with an external event that happens, and that would be something like prone sleep position, inappropriate bedding, those types of things. And so you need to have all – the idea is you would need to have all three of those in order for an infant to eventually die of SIDS.
In my – just looking back at some of the literature on this, my understanding is when you're prone, which means sleeping face down, that triples the likelihood of an infant having sudden infant death. Whereas, and when we, through educational efforts, spread the word throughout the world, not just in the United States, to put kids to sleep on their back, we've cut the risk, or the risk of death has been decreased by 50%. A huge
right.
public health advance, it seems to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's large and it's actually variable. So if you look in different countries, I think the decrease was from 30 to 80%. And so the area where they first discovered this, New Zealand, had the biggest decrease, which was 80%.
And they still have a pretty high – one of the higher rates.
Prone,
is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
And we monitor that through what's called the PRAM survey, Pregnancy Risk Assessment Monitoring System, which 18% of women in Alaska have completed that have had a live birth. And they're still – not, I wouldn't say a lot, but some prone sleep position. So, you know, we're trying to work to discourage that anytime it's not actually medically prescribed by a physician for other reasons like reflux.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind everybody, our number 550-8422. We're talking about sudden infant death or unexpected death of infants. In the first at least 6 months of life, or peaks in about 2 to 4 months, if I'm not mistaken. 550-8422, statewide, 1-800-478-8255, and our email address, line1@APRN.org. One of the thoughts that anybody who's doing research or thinking about this much want to think about is there a common denominator from all of these risk factors? Is there some common bit of information that may deserve further evaluation?
I'm not sure there's just one thing that would need evaluation, but I think there's two approaches to this, and that I have sort of think of SIDS research in my mind, and that is from a biologic mechanism point of view. And this is where you get a lot of research on things like, are there changes in autonomic responses to stress? So that would be something that would control your blood pressure, for example. And do infants who have certain stressors during prenatal life then have differences with respect to that later in life? And I think there's animal models for that that have been studied, as well as just studying infants that have had those issues. But then the other issue is more a public health approach, which is, regardless of all these things, are there things that we can identify that will allow us to prevent most SIDS deaths, regardless of what the biologic mechanism? And this gets back to the triple risk hypothesis. So if you have a vulnerable infant, that's more what a lot of people in basic science are studying. But what we're interested more in public health is, what is the insult after the kid comes out that then allows that vulnerable infant to die? And could we do something that it wouldn't matter if they were vulnerable? They would still live until they got past the first 6 months of life, and then it wouldn't be an issue. So one of the things we looked at is just looking at what are called demographic risk factors, which are just things like where somebody lives, what their education is, how much money they have, those types of things. And we looked at a bunch of those, and the three that really come out as important for predicting death after the first month of life are the mother's educational level, the mother's use of substances prenatally, which is mainly alcohol and cigarettes. And then the strongest risk factor actually is the presence of a father's name on the birth certificate. So there were three categories in that last category, which is married, unmarried, but the father's name is on the birth certificate, and unmarried and there's no father's name on the birth certificate. And it's that latter category that really, really increases the risk. And just to give you an idea of what we're talking about, if you have a well-educated mother, so more than a 12th grade education, who reports never using alcohol or cigarettes and is married, the post-neonatal mortality rate is something in the order of 2 per 1,000 live births. So out of every 1,000 infants born, 2 of them die. By contrast, if you have a infant born to a mother with all of those risk factors, so less than a 12th grade education, substance use documented, and no father's name on the birth certificate, that goes up to 30. So it's a 15-fold difference in risk just based on those identified risk factors. And I think the take-home message from that is not that it's so easy to increase educational levels of mothers or to have mothers stop prenatal drug use, but really that post-neonatal mortality is by and large preventable, that the great majority of it is something that we can prevent. It's not things that are mysterious like QT, prolonged QT syndrome or CPT1 deficiency or things like that by themselves. That children born into families with low levels of these risk factors just don't die or very rarely die. So our goal is to make that true for all infants born, regardless of what any underlying abnormalities are.
Okay. We have a couple of calls, it looks like. I want to take those, but this is interesting. I want to follow through on that. Charles, you're on line one?
Yeah, Bert.
What can we do for you?
Yeah, my only question is my son, I know that we're not supposed to put him face down, so that's not really an issue. And he's got a club foot, so the brace kind of makes it to where I don't really have a rolling issue. But he likes to sleep in that horseshoe pillow that most women use for breastfeeding and whatnot. Is elevation of the head any concern, or is the pillow in general ever been known to cause any problems?
Okay.
Well, I haven't seen any specific data. I know the horseshoe pillow you're talking about. For that specific pillow, big fluffy pillows where an infant's face could easily sort of sink into I think, are the things that you want to avoid. My the horseshoe pillows I've seen are pretty hard. And so it would be pretty hard for that to completely cover a mouth or a nose. And that's really, I think, where the risk from sleeping with pillows comes from. So my guess is he will be fine in a horseshoe pillow. You don't want to put, again, fluffy pillows, big heavy blankets, those type of things that could cover the face.
Okay. Okay. Well, that was really my only concern. Like I said, with he's got a club foot, so he's wearing that brace. It kind of keeps him from really rotating around or anything like that at that point. So.
Right. Okay.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks a lot.
Goodbye. Conrad, you're on line one.
Yeah, I wanted to know if you could talk about any of the surveys or the research that I read linking vaccines to SIDS. Mm-hmm. And one specifically I do remember was done in Japan when they stopped using vaccines as being mandated upon the public within a 2-year period. They had a decrease of, I believe, more than 90% in the death rate in SIDS in that country.
Okay.
Have you heard anything about these surveys, and what are your opinions about the research done here?
Well, I mean, I think that it's a legitimate question to wonder about SIDS and vaccines, and there have been plenty of people that have wondered that, and the main target of research was the pertussis vaccine, and that used to be what's called a whole cell pertussis vaccine, which was basically the entire pertussis organism in the vaccine. But even that vaccine was really well researched by several comprehensive studies in the U.S. and found not to be associated with SIDS. And now we don't even use that vaccine. We use what's called acellular, which is pertussis, which is just a few of the pieces of pertussis that provide protection without the other things. And I think that this brings up an excellent question of what's the progress of scientific inquiry. And usually what you first get is somebody that notices something, and it might be even a clinician, not a researcher, just somebody who says, you know, I've noticed in my practice that I've had 4 kids die of SIDS and all of them had received a vaccine. And so then the next step is, well, somebody looks at a larger series and they say, oh, you know, maybe that's possible. Eventually you get to what's called the definitive study. And that definitive study requires that you have a large number of people involved so you can make definitive statements, and that you have control groups so that you know what happened in the absence of that exposure. And that's what all of those case series miss. And the definitive studies associating vaccines with any type of SIDS, or really, I would say, any serious event, except in the most rare of circumstances, have all been negative. And in fact, there have been plenty of studies looking at that, and nobody has found anything that would suggest a problem. And one of the difficulties is that a lot of the websites, and I think without getting too much into this, for various reasons, stop at the earlier studies so that they can just defend their own point of view. So they only report on their websites these earlier case series or hypothesis generating studies, but they never report the results of the definitive data, because those definitive data have universally refuted their hypothesis of associations. And then just one more thing that I'll bring out is, if you just look at the broad epidemiology, there has never been a period when more vaccines have been used, and there has never been a period when there's been less SIDS. So,
yeah, that was the...
Well, one more further question about the studies. I read somewhere, you know, that they've made it illegal as far as the research, you know, that goes into the vaccines. It can be done by the companies that produces the vaccines themselves, and without the permission of an external, you know, independent study going on, without the permission from that company, it's considered illegitimate. You know, the FDA does not back that whatsoever.
Well, you can't use a vaccine in the United States that's not been approved by the FDA. And that's generally true in all countries, I think.
But what are the FDA standards is what I'm getting at here, because
they're more stringent than
squalene and swine flu vaccine. You know, these are independent studies that go on.
Squalene is the most recent mercury, and in fact, it's a natural product and it's in everything. You're getting way out of line. The other problem that you brought up is you said Japan was not recommending immunizations. I think Japan is one of the more highly immunized countries in the world. I think you need to check your facts. The immunization issue has been looked at hard. It doesn't seem to fit, and it is not true that immunizations cause sudden infant death, as far as anybody knows that's doing this research. It's been long, long ago worked over. Thanks for your call, Conrad.
Yeah, I'll check my sources. Yep.
Yeah, I would. I would look very closely at them. I don't know why vaccines seem to be blamed for everything that happens, but there's some very poor information.
There's a lot of quakey work going on behind the scenes here, and you know, our government is backed by a lot of these pharmaceutical companies that are now being pushed upon the people as far as health care and everything else. And I think it's all just a shame.
Well, I appreciate your opinions.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yep. Have a good day.
Let's see. We are past time for our break, so I'm going to go ahead and take a short break, then we'll come back. I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. In Anchorage, you can reach us at 550-8422. Our toll-free number, 1-800-478-8255. And you can email us at line1@aprn.org. After this break, we'll continue to take your calls and talk with Dr. Brad Gessner on Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Line 1, Your Health Connection, comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from the Lake Otis Pharmacy, prescription, support hose, medical equipment, and a full selection of satellites in Alaska. The Lake Otis Pharmacy on Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor, with the wheelchair on the sign. And by Providence Imaging Center, providing diagnostic imaging equipment, radiologists, technologists, and clerical staff committed to breast cancer detection. Information online at provimaging.com.
Listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. My guest today is Dr. Brad Gessner. He's an epidemiologist with the state of Alaska. Our topic is sudden infant death syndrome. You can email your questions to line1@aprn.org. Give us a call at 550-8422. Or outside of Anchorage, our phone number is 1-800-478-8255. And just this usual reminder, if you're listening between 8 and 9, you're listening to a taped rebroadcast, and we won't be able to answer your questions at that time. Dr. Gessner mentioned in the break that the last caller had brought up some concerns about vaccines, and I don't want to continue to harp on the vaccine issue, but Dr. Gessner has at least another comment about what we know may be some external factors related to reasons for sudden infant death, and how that could somehow be related to vaccines, however, in a positive way.
Yeah, I mean, just a very quick comment. Again, I don't want to belabor this because I think this is not an important issue for SIDS in the negative. But one of the hypotheses for, again, going back to that triple risk where you need the vulnerable infant, the early infant life, but then the external problem. One theory of what the external problem may frequently be is a bacterial toxin. And one of the bacterial toxins mentioned is pneumococcal or streptococcus pneumonia toxin, in addition to Staph aureus. And there is a vaccine already for pneumococcus. So, in fact, if anything, vaccines are likely to decrease the risk of SIDS, and they may further decrease it if we end up getting a vaccine against Staph aureus or something that's called methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. So I think if anything, vaccines will have a will decrease SIDS.
And we need to keep in mind the risk-benefit ratio of vaccines. In my last 20 years of practice, I have not seen – well, maybe it's 15 years. I've not seen a case of meningitis in my office. And before these vaccines, I used to see a couple of cases a year. And that was the most catastrophic, life-threatening illness that we saw. And yet we hear nothing hardly at all about the benefits of vaccines. So we need to comment on that as well, I think.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Another issue that you have looked at and vary in your opinion from other reviews of sudden infant deaths is the issue of co-sleeping, that is children sleeping in bed with parents as a risk factor. So the state of Alaska has put out bulletins on this. I tell my parents it's not a risk factor given certain criteria. Yet if you go and look on many websites, it's there. What's the story?
Right. So the official recommendation from the American Academy of Pediatrics is that in the first, if I recall correctly, 6 months of life, parents should not share a bed with their infant, regardless of the type of bed or any other activity that they engage in, including – you know, if they don't smoke, they don't drink, regardless, they should just never share a bed. And so I will say that the Division of Public Health where I work does not yet have an official policy on this. So I'll just put the disclaimer that these are my personal opinions based on the research I've done. But I think that the data we have in Alaska, and if you a careful review of the national data will show that it's not a risk factor and at least not anything close to the degree people have claimed. So, for example, we looked at every death that occurred in the post-neonatal period from 28 days to 365 days of life when most SIDS deaths occur. And we looked at those that were unexplained and then further focused on those where there was documented bed sharing or co-sleeping with the infant and at least one other person. And in every case but one, we could document very clearly defined risk factors, and they were the same risk factors we've discussed. So the infant was placed prone to sleep at bedtime, that it was an inappropriate sleeping surface, meaning a waterbed, a couch, something like that, or the parent had documented cigarette use or alcohol use the night of the child's death, not just sometime in the distant past. And the fact that – and I'm sure that there was more risk than we even documented because, as you can imagine, when an infant dies of SIDS, it's not so easy to get that information from a parent. So – just those grouping of risk factor really decreased the risk of bed sharing to what essentially is zero. And this is from 1992 to 2006, so a 14 or 15-year period of looking at that. Mm-hmm. So I think that – and if you look at the other studies that have been done that have assigned bed sharing a prominent role, there was only one that actually controlled for things like cigarette smoking and alcohol use. And that study found a very small effect of bed sharing. I think it increased the risk by 20%, something like that. I mean, very small, and only during the first 8 weeks of life, with no effect after that period. So my own personal recommendation, and we're working on this issue in the Division of Public Health to come up with a consistent recommendation for the state, is that parents should place their infant to sleep on their back, that they should not smoke or drink, and infants should sleep either in a crib or on a parent's normal bed with a non-substance-using parent. Mm-hmm. And if everyone were doing that, the data on SIDS from Alaska suggests that there would be essentially no SIDS deaths. Related to bed sharing by itself.
So what you're saying also is that the bed sharing is just a coincidental finding that just tracks along for one reason or the other. right. with these other more important risk factors.
Exactly. And we have data from what I talked about before, the PRAM survey, that shows that, as you might imagine, there are lots of women in Alaska who bed share with their infant and who don't drink or smoke. And yet none of those infants are showing up in our data as having died of SIDS.
Right.
So bed sharing by itself really appears to be not a, not a important risk factor at all. And I really think we should focus on other risk factors. And I'll just make one more comment. People have made the argument that, okay, well, maybe if you don't sleep with – if you don't smoke or drink alcohol or have these other risk factors – your infant isn't at risk. But let's just make a broad-based recommendation not to sleep with your infant. And for those who do have those risk factors, at least those infants will survive.
Right.
But even that is not true necessarily, because if you could identify those infants prospectively, sure, you could prevent those. But you don't know who those infants are until after they've died. And so infants that are in homes where people smoke and drink a lot, and where the parents are not well educated, don't know to put their kid on their back to sleep, that whole group of infants, if they didn't co-sleep, some of those would have survived, but they would have potentially died in a different circumstance. So you may have exactly the same rate of infant mortality in that group, even if you implemented that policy. So I don't think there's any data, even that having every woman put their infant in a crib will actually decrease the SIDS rate, at least in Alaska. And it's potentially even harmful, because it's definitely will affect breastfeeding rates. I think there's research on that. And then there's the hypothetical risk of impacting bonding, which this gets into whether that would then affect things like child abuse.
And breastfeeding has a protective effect.
Breastfeeding has a protective effect on SIDS and a whole host of other issues.
And again, it may not be that breastfeeding causes it. It may be that breastfeeding just tracks along with families who are less likely to have.
Right.
That's the point we're trying to make, is that it's very, very difficult to sometimes tease it out, and you got to do the really good research to answer those kinds of questions. And
yeah, no, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so, again, I mean, it would just be nice to have infants in homes where, as a first priority, there was no substance use, and I will put in cigarettes and alcohol during that early 6-month period, because I think those are so well documented as risk factors that it would be nice to get people to stop doing that.
I'm trying to think. We have a caller calling in about bed sharing. I want to get to her, but I'm trying to think about what about before we had kids turned over from sleeping on their stomach to on their back? You know, how did that significant change have to do? How does that relate with co-sleeping? You know, is there anything we can gain from that? I'm not sure I can come up with anything, but
yeah, I mean, prone sleeping, I think, in most. And there's lots of, I think, good studies on that, is an independent risk factor in any place that a child is put down. And I think
that doesn't make any difference. Yeah.
Well, there may be some interaction, but it's a risk factor in any bed setting.
Okay. So. All right. Rachel, you're on line one.
Thank you. I just wanted to say I have a 9-month-old daughter. I breastfeed, no substance use. And from when I brought her home, she was never interested in sleeping anywhere but right at my nipple. And we have happily shared the bed ever since. The thing that I wanted to ask was, you know, there's so much information out there of what parents should do, but babies don't ever get that information. So they don't know that they're supposed to sleep on their back or, you know, not press their heads right into, you know, their mother's bosom when they're sleeping. And like my daughter, she would not sleep anywhere else. She wouldn't sleep by herself. She wouldn't sleep on her back. And if I tried battling it, she would never sleep and I would never sleep.
Right.
So I think that with the education, there should be more help out there for parents whose kids aren't compiling with the recommendations.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a couple of issues here that come to my mind. Let me come in. One of them is you're not alone. As a pediatrician, I can tell you the vast majority of mothers who breastfeed, that baby is in bed with them at night. Mm-hmm. Okay, it is, you know, to me it's the exception, and it's an industrious, hardworking mom who's going to get up and put the bed outside of the bed. And so that's one issue. And two, there's this issue of guilt that you feel like you're doing something wrong. And what I'm hearing Dr. Cruz say, Dr. Gessner, I'm sorry, say is that, you know, the evidence is not as strong as it appears, and this may just – it appears to be – really, when you look at it, is just a an unhappy coincidence rather than a real causal thing. And breastfeeding is protective, so I don't. And then once you get past 6 months, another issue that I thought of that you said, you know, mom said, "Gosh, I can't keep my 9-month-old on their back." Very true.
Yeah.
You know, but the big risk is up to the first 6 months. It's not so much of an issue. Now with babies on their back, they don't roll over and sleep quite so much. So I don't think you should feel guilty if that's what you're saying. And I think
no,
you should keep...
I'm not really feeling guilty. Just really wanting to let... Because you're right, I'm not alone. And I want other moms to know and other pediatricians, because my pediatrician, every checkup, oh, you're still co-sleeping.
That's a good point. Yeah.
I got the talk about SIDS, and I told him, I'm like, first of all, my daughter would not sleep by herself, and I feel like her sleeping next to me helps regulate her heart rate, and I'm in tune with her enough that if she moves, if something happens, I wake up, and I'm able to address it. If she was in a crib, I wouldn't know, and I just felt like the information he was giving me not to co-sleep because it was a risk for SIDS was...
Right.
It didn't go along with what I like naturally felt that I could tell what was going on with my daughter if she was right there by me.
Yeah,
so I know it doesn't work for every parent, but it worked for me, and it just. But you're right. There is a sense of guilt.
Yeah. Well, so, it's unfortunate that the even the Academy of Pediatrics has a statement that says that it's opposed. So. And when most mothers do it, it can't help but cause some consternation and concern and worry about mothers, which unfortunately would be also inappropriate if what Dr. Gessner's saying is correct. And I really think he is correct myself, to be honest with you, although I'm not a researcher in this. I think he's a very, very critical thinker, and I think if you really look at the information hard, it's probably like he says, but we don't have enough strong information to really take that recommendation out since it's already gotten in there. And once the information like that gets in, it's very hard to take it out. So,
Well, thank you guys for your comments because I know it made me feel better, and I'm sure it made a lot of moms who are just starting out feel much better.
Yeah, I think it's very much worthwhile continuing to keep an open conversation with pediatricians or physicians that are giving you that advice. I think it's safe. I've had four daughters. They all co-bed share, and they all breastfed. So that's my tip.
Thank you so much for doing this show.
Okie doke. Have a good day.
Brad,
other comments? I dominated that, but I was a pediatrician.
That's right. I could see you were on a roll. I figured I'd just sit here and stay quiet.
Well, you're a pretty critical thinker. I get too emotional sometimes.
No, I think that, I still do some pediatrics at the neighborhood health center, and I do the same thing. I mean, I recommend that there are certain things to do to decrease the risk, and not bed sharing is not one of those. I say, you know, you can bed share, but just make sure if you're sleeping with your infant that you're not, that nobody in the bed is smoking or drinking or taking any other substance that could affect whether they arouse or not. And this is one of the things I referred to earlier, and that's that smoking it causes arousal and a lot of people smoke to stay awake. But once you fall asleep, you're in a much deeper sleep and much harder to arouse. So that's possibly where postnatal cigarette smoking may cause some of its impact with SIDS. So again, it should be a normal, hard, just standard adult mattress, no smoking, alcohol. And the data we have here suggests that there's essentially no increased risk of SIDS from doing that. Doesn't guarantee that a baby might not die in sleep, but some of those infants will die in their sleep no matter where they are. There's just a background rate of these very strange and rare, fortunately, prenatal events that happen that lead to deaths. But again, bed sharing is not one of them. I think bed sharing is safe when it's done correctly.
And the other thing I'm hearing you say is by getting parents to have children sleep on their backs, we've had a tremendous impact. If we could do these other simple things, smoking, the kind of bedding you're in, no drinking, maybe some social factors, which you've mentioned, that we could have an even almost an equivalent impact so that we could get that rate down to very, very low numbers, which are due to very rare problems that we know also are sitting in that group of kids that are dying. But they're very inconsequential as best we can tell.
Right, exactly. I mean, I think we could easily take it down by another 50% to 60% just by a few of these simple measures that include appropriate bedding, more having everybody put their infant to sleep on their back, and you know, just stop using drugs for 15 months, you know, 9 months of pregnancy and 6 months afterwards, and that's really the biggest risk period.
And we maybe should. My thought is, again, is the use of alcohol and other drugs, but alcohol and cigarette smoke, which are the most – and smoking is the most common. Early in pregnancy may have lots of other potential mechanisms with which they could affect kids, especially very, very early in pregnancy. And
We haven't gone into all
that, but, I mean, there's a lot of mechanisms, a lot of reasons for trying not to do that.
Right, exactly. I mean, I think that cigarettes, compared to even some of the illegal drugs that people emphasize, probably have a bigger impact, you know, even than some things like heroin or cocaine, which, again, are good not to do. But I think we really just have to point the finger at cigarettes because it's damaging on so many levels to the fetus and young infants.
Anytime, I've stressed this over and over and over again, anytime you do any treatment, there's risks and benefits. So there's lots of benefits from back to sleep. What are the bad things that can happen with back to sleep? There are no risk-free options here.
Well, there's not so many. It's pretty close to a risk-free option. I mean, one of the big ones that I think just concerns parents the most is what's called plagiocephaly, which is you get a flat back of your head or a flat occiput. And the recommendation for that is while the child is awake to have them – is basically to hold them or to have them not putting weight on the back of their head as much as possible so that they don't increase their exposure more than they need to just based on their SIDS risk. So that would be one thing. Another issue would be that there are – probably some benefits to stomach sleeping for, or at least side sleeping for some infants, such as those that have substantial reflux that might otherwise aspirate some food. And then that's something to just discuss with the family physician about whether, in their opinion, the risk outweigh the benefits of one position versus the other. And anyway.
Yeah, I was going to bring up the aspiration issue. I mean, that certainly was the reason I remember giving parents to keep their kids sleeping on their stomach or when they were younger is that if they spit up, they may choke and gag and aspirate. Aspirate means getting contents in your mouth down into your lungs and not a good place for that to be and might affect breathing and illness and so forth. So that doesn't seem to have come about. We're not seeing more aspiration because of this. And reflux is that spitting up, sometimes very dramatic, that happens in almost all infants, but many. And then it increases at 2-4 months of age commonly when their volume of food is increasing. So that's at least circumstantially associated with this. But it's not been shown to be a factor, is what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah, I don't know that there's really good data that reflux, and again, I might make the exception with some severe reflux, is really associated with SIDS. And in fact, there's going back to the hypothesis that there's a decreased ability of a vulnerable infant to arouse themselves from sleep. The prone sleep position actually is associated with a decreased arousal response. So if you have these small amounts of aspiration and a little micro aspiration event that then causes hypoxia and you're in the prone position, you might actually be less likely to arouse even with the reflux than you would if you were on your back, where you might inhale a little, but then you might cough and arouse and find a way to start breathing again.
So what research are you doing now along this lines? Are you continuing to look at the incidents in Alaska and causal factors?
Yeah. I mean, I think we get a lot of support within our section from this section chief, Stephanie Birch, and we have a whole staff with that does research on this issue. Margaret Blaby runs the analysis part of maternal infant mortality review and child death review. And then Jared Parrish is doing a lot of work on child maltreatment and how that may be associated with a lot of these events that are called SIDS. Not that they're homicides, but that child maltreatment and neglect actually contribute to unintentional infant deaths. So we're doing a lot of work looking for very specific causes of SIDS that would be amenable to public health interventions. And we're tracking the rates to see if they're going down. We're trying to come up with interventions that we can implement. And the most recent is what's called the Safe Sleep Initiative. And it's trying to develop a policy within the state to recommend to people about how to have your young infant sleep safely.
Got just about a minute. Let's leave with the tips for safe sleeping for infants. What's the best recommendations you can give young mothers, pregnant mothers, mothers that are breastfeeding?
Right. So starting with prenatal life, don't smoke and drink in terms of the SIDS risk. And in the postnatal life, put the infant to sleep on its back in a safe environment, which would include either a crib or a standard adult mattress, and if they're in either place, they should not have extraneous, loose, and particularly thick bedding that could suffocate an infant. And if they are in the parent's bed, that anybody in that bed should not have been smoking, drinking, or taking any other substance that might cause them to have a particularly deep sleep.
Okay.
That's it.
Another fast hour. Thanks very much for your time and your expertise.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Dr. Brad Gessner, for a wonderful hour. Remember, we're going to be back next week, and we're going to keep hammering away at what's going on with healthcare legislation, and we'll be talking with Washington, D.C. healthcare economist Dr. Gail Walensky. She's in the middle of this. She knows what's going on. We're going to be asking her what's developing, what will it mean for our healthcare system and our economy, and what is not being addressed that needs to be. Pat Yak is Vice President of APTI News and Public Media. Kristen Speck helped us by engineering today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400. Stroke is an emergency. Providence, Alaska Medical Center is committed to increasing awareness of the symptoms of stroke. If you or anyone you know has sudden weakness on one side of your body, sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding, sudden trouble seeing, walking, or loss of balance, or sudden severe headaches without cause, call 911 and get to the hospital within 1 hour. Information at providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence, Alaska Medical Center.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.